Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, July 18th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, County Approves $270,000 Horseshoe Settlement, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland County Commissioner's Court voted Monday to approve a settlement agreement with Horseshoe Hospitality Services that will pay Horseshoe Hospitality Services $270,000. The settlement agreement is intended to resolve the dispute concerning the Horseshoe's continuing management of the multipurpose facility. Midland County and Horseshoe Hospitality Services, LLC, are pleased to announce that they have reached a mutual agreement to ensure a smooth transition of the Horseshoe Pavilion and Amphitheater that will now be managed by Midland County, effective August 1, 2023. A statement from County Judge Terry Johnson's office stated, Midland County appreciates the services that Horseshoe Hospitality Services, LLC, has rendered at the Horseshoe facility over the past years. Both Midland County and Horseshoe Hospitality Services, LLC, agree that the resolution reached between them is fair to both Horseshoe Hospitality Services, LLC, and the taxpayers of Midland County. A mediation session between the county and Joe Kelly of Horseshoe Hospitality Services regarding the termination of the contract took place Friday. The settlement will allow the county to move in a different direction when it comes to operations of the facility in South Midland. On May 8th, Midland County Commissioners voted 3-2 to terminate their contract with Horseshoe Hospitality Services. In late June, commissioners hired Ken Olson, the former managing director for Midland Community Theater, to be the new director of the Horseshoe Complex. Olson's salary is $127,237.33, according to county officials. Kelly's compensation agreement, while he was operator at the Horseshoe Complex, included a salary of $140,000. The parties agree that all accounts receivable for money owed on events that have occurred at the facility, Horseshoe Complex, or will occur at the facility through the end of July 31, 2023, will be paid to the parties pursuant to the contract between the county and HHS, according to a settlement term. The county shall receive 100% on all accounts receivable for money owed on events occurring at the facility after July 31, 2023, and will be responsible for all expenses pertaining to events occurring at the facility after July 31, 2023. The agreement also states that the Horseshoe Hospitality Services return 75% of all unused funds previously paid by the county to Horseshoe Hospitality Services pursuant to the contract as of July 31st. It also states Horseshoe Hospitality Services is entitled to retain the remaining 25% of all such unused funds. Horseshoe Hospitality Services also will remove all personal property by August 1st, including its own equipment, its ATV, its food and beverage inventory, its kitchen smallwares, and its point-of-sale system. Also, during a period from August 1st to September 30th, Horseshoe Hospitality Services will provide consulting services pertaining to the operation of the facility, as requested, at a per diem of $550 a day. Horseshoe Hospitality Services will also assist in transition of the management of the facility to Midland County. Lastly, Midland County will consider all Horseshoe Hospitality employees for employment, and Horseshoe Hospitality Services will allow the county's Human Resources Director to visit with any employees interested. The county agreed to make hiring decisions no later than August 1st, and the agreement covers HHS employees for accrued personal time, sick leave, and vacation time through July 31st. Both parties limited their comments to the statement provided by the county judge's office. This article is entitled "Apartment Fire Impacts 8 Units" by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Fire Department responded to a fire Saturday in the 4700 block of Boulder Drive at the Fairmont Condos, according to the City of Midland. At approximately 4:40 p.m., crews with the Midland Fire Department responded to the fire, the city reported. Fire investigators believe the fire started in a second-floor apartment and spread to the unit beneath, the city reported. A total of 8 units are affected by the fire, with electricity cut to all apartments and smoke affecting all 8 units. No injuries were reported, and so far 4 families have been notified, accounting for 5 adults and 1 child, according to the city. Red Cross has been notified to assist families in need. This article is entitled "City Reports Consistent Animal Save Rate." Midland Animal Shelter Employees Step Up While Waiting for New Director, by Stuart Doreen. Employees at the Midland Animal Shelter stepped up to keep the animal save rate at levels consistent over the previous 2 years. During the Animal Services Advisory Commission meeting, officials reported an animal save rate of 75% in May and 74% in June. That happened even as the shelter has dealt with an increased number of animals picked up on average, staff shortages, and turmoil that even reached the Midland City Council. Director of Community Services Christina Burns told commissioners animal intake in May reached 383, and that 127 of those were transferred to rescues, 99 adopted, and 97 were euthanized. The animal save rate, according to the City of Midland, is determined by taking the intake minus euthanasia outcomes and dividing that number by the number of intakes. In June, there were 528 intakes, 119 animals adopted, 135 euthanized, and 85 transferred to rescues. Burns stated that the higher number of intakes was responsible for the lower animal save rate in June. That trend is consistent with the city's former animal services director, whose time at the Midland Animal Shelter included a lower average of intakes a month, 429, compared to 515 during the previous 12 months prior to his arrival, and a lower percentage of animals that went through intake that ultimately were euthanized, 23.84% from 27.89%. City officials noted that 157 of the 232 animals were euthanized because of medical or behavioral concerns. Impact of hot summer. Commission officials said steps are in place to help the animal services employees do their job more effectively during a heated summer in Midland. Officials said measures are in place when animals are picked up that will hopefully avoid animal deaths. Those measures include bringing an animal immediately back to the Midland Animal Shelter, having water available for an animal in the truck and at the shelter, having fans, AC, and cooling pads available at the Sallyport area at the shelter. Have 2 workers traveling together in trucks instead of 1. Officials said that 2 of the 6 trucks have AC available in the area where animals are transported. 2 more have been ordered, according to city officials. Officials also said the shelter is working with guidelines and policies in place. They call those operating manuals living documents. Animal Services Advisory Commission notables. The City of Midland will again open the animal shelter on Tuesdays, beginning August 15th. The shelter has been closed to the public on Tuesday to allow staff to concentrate on cleaning the facility and caring for animals. Commissioners discussed the need for better conversation, especially on social media. The discussion included what commissioners, rescue officials, and other concerned Midlanders are putting out to the public. The discussion included best practices to serve the community while also being advocates for animals. A new animal services director is slated to begin on August 1st. City officials have stated they are not yet ready to release the woman's name. Burns also said that 15 of the 22 budgeted positions in the Animal Services Department are currently filled. She told commissioners that work is still taking place to employ a veterinarian, whether that is a city hire or a partnership with the City of Odessa. This article is entitled Congressman to EPA. Don't Trust Texas to Oversee Carbon Storage, by Mitchell Furman, Bloomberg. Two Texas congressmen are urging the Environmental Protection Agency to reject their state's effort to oversee underground carbon storage and are calling for an investigation, arguing local regulators can't be trusted to protect the public. The EPA currently regulates underground carbon storage across most of the country, except in North Dakota and Wyoming, which have been approved to oversee their own efforts. The EPA has minimal staff to regulate subsurface carbon storage, and companies are increasingly interested in capturing carbon and storing it underground, due largely to economic incentives from the Inflation Reduction Act. Texas Democratic U.S. Representatives Joaquin Castro and Lloyd Doggett said in a letter Monday to EPA boss Michael Reagan that they are concerned over their state's enforcers, the Texas Railroad Commission, which is in charge of regulating oil, gas, and related activities. They want federal regulators to investigate Texas's permitting and enforcement of subsurface injections to ensure it adheres to environmental justice standards. The Railroad Commission of Texas can't be trusted to uphold the standards that protect health and safety in communities with carbon capture infrastructure, Castro said in a statement. Moreover, Texas regulators are unwilling to meet their existing obligations to plug abandoned oil wells. The EPA must not give the Commission more oversight over carbon storage wells and related infrastructure, which are disproportionately located in communities of color, already exposed to dangerous levels of pollution. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled EIA, Shale Oil Production in U.S. to Decline, by Mitchell Furman, Bloomberg. Shale production in the U.S. will start to decline in August after hitting record highs in June and July, according to a government report. The drop, led by falling output in the oil-rich Permian Basin, will see U.S. crude production hit 9.4 million barrels a day in August, ending 7 months of continuous growth. Combined with production cuts from the OPEC Plus alliance, the U.S. decline is expected to tip the world's oil supply into deficit by the end of the year. The slowdown is also evident in a drop in the number of wells that have been drilled but not completed, which shows American shale producers are clearing up a backlog. This article is entitled Gutfeld Co-host Coming to Wagner Noel in Midland, by Stuart Doreen. Kat Timpf, a co-host on the Fox News Channel show Gutfeld, will appear at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center in August. Tickets are available for Timpf's You Can't Joke About That event on August 26th. Timpf's website describes her as a writer, comedian, and libertarian commentator. Kat stands out in a sea of pundits because of her libertarian perspective and use of comedy and satire to get her no-nonsense points across, her website states. While she is steadfast in her strong libertarian beliefs, Kat is a firm believer in the power of conversation to bridge gaps, political or otherwise. Gutfeld isn't just one of the most popular shows on Fox News Channel. It competes head-to-head in most of the country with other late-night shows, according to the Wall Street Journal. It averaged more than 1.8 million viewers from the end of February through early May, according to the Journal. That's higher than ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live, whose audience was more than 1.5 million in the same period, and NBC's The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, which was watched by nearly 1.4 million people, according to Nielsen data. On occasion, it has drawn a bigger audience than the industry leader CBS's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, which averaged almost 2.1 million viewers, the Journal reported. Online, therealkattimpf.com. Tickets, wagnernoel.com/events/detail/cat-timpf-2023. This column is called Opinion. It is entitled Irresponsible Pet Owners, Not City, Create Animal Services Chaos by Stuart Doreen, Midland Reporter Telegram editor. There has been entirely too much chaos when it comes to dogs and cats in Midland. Animal support and rescue groups are at odds, and the city of Midland has a target on its back. Today's opinion article isn't to comment on the city of Midland or any animal organization. It is to tell our community that we have a pet problem. The number one reason is because collectively we are irresponsible pet owners, and there will continue to be animals that are put to death until Midlanders, not the city of Midland or animal organizations, get our act together. It is depressing scrolling down the Midland Animal Shelter's roster of animals because the animals are so precious and too many will not be around much longer. While some people disagree and animal organizations across the community are working their butts off to prevent it, the city has no choice. Irresponsible pet owners and haters of animals will continue to make euthanasia a requirement as the shelter exists, to safeguard public health, protect animal welfare, provide community care and services for animals that have come into the shelter. I wish that list could include act as a long-term rescue for all animals, but that is not the case. We have too many Midlanders who have put their own interests above the interests of dogs and cats, and those people who work at the Midland Animal Shelter. Animals will continue to die, and that is an extremely difficult pill to swallow. One thing I do believe is that the city of Midland was right in the direction during the past few months with its animal services department. While previous leadership showed the community some good ideas, it ultimately proved its critics right by showing up during a Midland City Council meeting to go on the offensive with his own prosecution of city staff. He showed he couldn't be trusted, and new city management deserved to work with someone with a clean slate. We have seen elected leaders attempt to score points with this animal crisis, and we have seen it spectacularly blow up in the face of the community. If one is interested in silver linings, there are some. The Midland City Council will take seriously the time limit someone has to speak in front of the council, and we now know that council meetings are not the proper place for a community discussion about animal services. That place is the Animal Services Advisory Committee. What is also certain, and I seem to be the lone voice in support of the city on this point, is there is no disputing the investment the Midland City Council has made in its Animal Services Department. The City of Midland has a relatively new 18,400-square-foot facility, It opened in October 2021, and a $2.323 million Animal Services Division budget, which is not only an increase of 31% compared to the previous fiscal year, but a jump of $1 million, or 75%, compared to fiscal year 2019, according to animal services budgets provided by the city. That includes an increase in base salaries for animal services employees from $523,100 in fiscal year 2019 to $991,402 this year, an increase of 89%. Our community also has a legion of animal lovers willing to fight tooth and nail for those dogs and cats that live out their lives in a kennel at the shelter or at rescues across the city. While there is an abundance of love for our precious four-legged friends, there are more animals than homes. Why? Because we as a community have allowed it to happen. We must have an honest discussion about policies that will cut the population of animals at the shelter and inside rescues across Midland. We must ask about penalties for those, including those who don't believe they are part of the problem, who don't have their animals spayed or neutered, and then allow their animal to leave their property to wander a neighborhood. We must ask about best practices that allow the animal support groups to work with the city of Midland, because there is great work being done with those groups, but keep safeguarding public health as a requirement. Our shelter can't drop its euthanasia rate at the expense of not picking up strays or dangerous animals. I think our community has the ability to put forward a plan with a new animal services director and renewed focus on its Animal Services Advisory Committee to be the board where best practices are determined. The welfare of dogs and cats can't be considered as a political football at the council level moving forward. Our community needs to move forward from the chaos. I admit this article is not going to sit well with some people. There are some who believe we can save every life of every animal at the shelter and currently wandering our streets. I wish I shared such optimism. The problem is that requires depending on others in the community, and unfortunately, irresponsible pet owners have forced a situation on many, including the people who work at the Midland Animal Shelter. That is inexcusable. This article is entitled, Is NWS Calling for 100 Degree Streaks End? By Stuart Doreen. The 100 degree hot weather streak continued this weekend and Monday, but the National Weather Service is showing a cooler light at the end of the tunnel. The NWS is calling for a high of 98 degrees on Saturday and 99 degrees on Sunday. If the forecast is accurate, that means Midland's second double-digit 100 streak of the summer will end at 13 days, the fourth longest streak on record in Midland. There will be some pain before Midlanders get there, or heat. The National Weather Service is calling for high temperatures of 108 degrees and 107 degrees on Tuesday and Wednesday, respectively. The hot conditions and lack of rainfall this year mean Midland is dangerously close to forcing county officials to call another burn ban. The Keech-Byram Drought Index showed an average score of 566 in Midland County. At 575, it is likely county officials would ask commissioners to call for the first burn ban since late summer 2022. Weather Report. Monday's high, 103 degrees. Typical high for July 17th, 96 degrees. Monday's low, 77 degrees. Typical low for July 17th, 73. Record high for July 17th, 108 in 1989. Number of straight days at or above 100 degrees, 9 days. last 9 days. Sunday, 103 degrees. Monday, 103. Tuesday, 105. Wednesday, 110. Thursday, 106. Friday, 104. Saturday, 103. Sunday, 100. Monday, 103. Next 5 days. Tuesday, 108 degrees. Wednesday, 107. Thursday, 103. Friday, 102. Saturday, 98 degrees. Source: National Weather Service. This article is entitled Police. Alvin Man Dies in Motorcycle Crash. A 20-year-old man from Alvin died early Saturday morning after crashing his motorcycle in Southwest Midland, according to Midland Police. MPD reported that at approximately 2:17 a.m., officials with the Midland Police Department Traffic Division responded to a fatality accident involving a motorcycle in the 800 block of Tradewinds Boulevard, just south of Leisure Drive. Investigators determined the driver of the motorcycle was Dalton Lane Sanders from Alvin. Sanders was traveling northbound on Tradewinds Boulevard at a high rate of speed and lost control of the motorcycle, resulting in the crash, MPD reported. Sanders was pronounced deceased at the scene. Next of kin have been notified. The fatality is the 23rd reported inside Midland County this year, according to Reporter-Telegram records. This article is entitled Police Make Second Arrest in Fatal Odessa Shooting by Mercedes Cordero. The Odessa Police Department has made a second arrest in connection with a fatal shooting that left a 16-year-old dead and four others injured. Javen Landerth, 18, of Odessa, was arrested and charged with capital murder in the June 29th shooting at Carriage House Apartments in central Odessa. The city of Odessa stated Friday that Landerth was being treated at Medical Center Hospital for injuries sustained from the shooting. Odessa police have also arrested a 16-year-old identified as KSO for capital murder. An arrest warrant has been issued for a third suspect, Cannon Shorter, 18. Shorter is wanted for capital murder and is considered a fugitive. On June 29th, at about 9:32 p.m., OPD officers responded to a call of shots fired and a gunshot victim at the Carriage House Apartments, 4306 North Dixie Boulevard. As officers were arriving on the scene, a truck containing multiple victims arrived at Odessa Regional Medical Center. An OPD sergeant already at the hospital for an unrelated call confirmed the shooting victims were at the hospital. The four people suffering from gunshot wounds were rushed into the hospital, where one of them, a 16-year-old male, was pronounced dead, according to the city of Odessa. The 16-year-old victim has been identified as Gonzalo Diaz, Jr. An investigation revealed that all the individuals involved met in the parking lot of Carriage House Apartments to conduct an unlawful firearm transaction, according to the city of Odessa. Surveillance video revealed that three subjects approached the vehicle occupied by the deceased party, Diaz, and three others. According to OPD, Shorter and KSO began shooting into the vehicle, injuring three and killing Diaz. Anyone with information about Shorter's whereabouts is encouraged to contact OPD at 432-333-3641 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS. Shorter is considered to be armed and dangerous. This article is entitled Study Finds Yellow Cars Hold Best Value by Mella McEwen. The latest study from IC Cars, the car search and research company, found car colors can impact a car's value. Results for Midland-Odessa closely tracked the rest of the nation, finding yellow cars hold the best value with a 3-year depreciation of 16.6%, or $8,113. Black cars lost the most value with a 3-year depreciation of 21.7%, or $9,959. The average 3-year depreciation is 20.7%, or $9,357. The color can affect how quickly a car loses its value, costing consumers up to $5,000 for choosing the one that depreciates most. After analyzing the prices of more than 1.3 million vehicles, the latest IC Cars study determined which colors help, hurt, or have minimal impact on resale value. A casual glance at roadways or parking lots suggests black, white, and silver are the most popular colors, said IC Cars executive analyst Carl Brower. That may be true, but there are more than enough cars painted those colors to fill market demand, which hurts resale value. Buyers looking for above-average resale value need to buy non-average colors, including yellow, beige, orange, and green. Nationally, for SUVs, yellow held the top ranking for resale value, followed by green, orange, and purple. For pickup trucks, beige scored best, as it often is associated with special off-road trims on multiple truck models in recent years. For sedans, brown is the top color. For more information, access the complete study at iccars.com/car-color-study. This article is entitled, U.S. Oil Caverns Sit Empty in Threat to Energy Security, by Ari Natter, Bloomberg. Scroll through the West Hackberry Oil Field facility on the U.S. Gulf Coast, and there's not much to see, some pipelines and other industry equipment. But buried deep beneath the surface are storage caverns so massive they're tall enough to house the Empire State Building, with plenty of room to spare. These reserve sites are supposed to hold enough backup supply to ensure the U.S. never runs short of oil. Right now, they're sitting half empty. It only took about 6 months for the Biden administration to sell off 180 million barrels from the federal stash in the fastest withdrawal on record. But refilling it to capacity would likely take decades, if it happens at all. Experts say that a lack of funding and aging infrastructure will plague the process, even as the Energy Department has pledged to keep buying. In the meantime, with the reserve at its lowest level in 40 years, the U.S. could be vulnerable to oil price shocks. It also means that during domestic supply crunches, the nation will be left to the mercy of global exporters like Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the rest of the OPEC Plus cartel. The issue has also created yet another political firestorm, as Republicans have blasted the Biden administration for its record drawdown. Mandated yearly sales starting in 2017 meant that the reserves had already been seeing small but steady declines. Then came Russia's invasion of Ukraine in early 2022, and with it a surge in global oil prices that fed through into fuel inflation. To combat the spike, President Joe Biden undertook an unprecedented selling campaign, ordering 180 million barrels out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, nearly five times bigger than any previous sale. Gasoline prices soon began to peak and are down more than 20% in the past year. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve, known as the SPR, currently stands at 346.8 million barrels, the lowest level since 1983, and equal to about 18 days' worth of supplies. The total authorized storage capacity is 714 million. Now that energy costs are back down, comes the task of refilling the reserve. That will be a complicated, expensive process. Oil prices are now much higher than when most of the inventory was originally bought. The average price paid for oil in the reserve was $29.70 per barrel, which compares with the current benchmark cost for U.S. crude futures at about $75. And there's the balance between needing to buy and not purchasing too much at once, lest the oil market gets spooked and prices jump higher. It would be a very slow process, even if you had the money and the facilities were all in good shape. John Shags, who previously oversaw the oil cache for the Energy Department, said in an interview, "It could take decades." Oil embargo. The emergency cache was first set up in the 1970s, after the Arab oil embargo that created a global energy supply shock and shortage of gasoline in the U.S. Americans would line up for hours to fill their tanks. Some stations even became by appointment only. While the U.S. itself has since become the world's biggest crude producer, thanks to prolific shale fields in the Permian Basin, the country is also still an importer. That means the SPR still serves an important function, like a kind of doomsday insurance against catastrophes and geopolitical turbulence that can disrupt the flow of shipments. In 2005, for example, when Hurricane Katrina knocked out Gulf production, reserved sales helped to bolster domestic supplies. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm recently reiterated a pledge to refill the stockpiles. But the department has also conceded that a complete refill is unlikely anytime soon. Political battle. Republicans from both chambers of Congress have dismissed the Biden administration's oil releases as a ploy to bring down gasoline prices before the midterm elections last year in November. They have accused the administration of having no credible plan to refill the reserve. DOE's mismanagement of the SPR has undermined America's energy security, leaving the nation more vulnerable to energy supply disruptions and increasing the ability for OPEC and Russia to use energy as a geopolitical weapon. Top House and Senate Republicans wrote in a May letter to the Government Accountability Office, asking the federal watchdog for an audit of the reserve. Tight budget. So far, the pace of the refill stands to be a trickle. The DOE plans to replace at least the barrels sold last year and counts the cancellation of previously mandated sales towards its goal to replenish the reserves, the agency said previously in an email to Bloomberg. This leaves at least 40 million barrels left to purchase, of which the agency has already committed to purchasing 12 million barrels for deliveries later this year. But returning the SPR to its 2009 peak would mean purchasing of more than 300 million barrels. Congress stripped away some $12.5 billion from the Energy Department earmarked for reserve oil purchases last year when it canceled 140 million barrels worth of sales that had been previously mandated. Now the department is left with roughly $4.3 billion to purchase oil, enough for roughly 61 million barrels at prices around $70 a barrel, said Kevin Book, managing director of Washington-based consulting firm Clearview Energy Partners. With Congress hyper-focused on reducing deficits and the budget, it's unlikely more funding will be provided anytime soon, he added. the DOE didn't address Bloomberg's queries about budgetary constraints to refilling the reserve. Aging facilities. The Gulf Coast salt caverns that comprised the 70s-era reserve were built with a 25-year lifespan in mind. They were designed for just 5 drawdowns and refills, said William Hoot Gibson, the reserve's former project manager. The more the system is used, the higher the risk the salt caverns will dissolve. 2 of the reserve sites in Texas and Louisiana are currently offline for maintenance. A $1.4 billion modernization program funded through oil sales is behind schedule and over budget, with the Biden administration asking Congress for an additional $500 million for the project last year. There are infrastructural challenges at the reserve simply because of how it is designed and how it has been used over the past decade, said Tristan Abbey, who received routine briefings on the state of the reserve while serving as a director on the National Security Council during the Trump administration. The caverns are made out of salt, and they are not really intended for a daily ATM-type operations. The Energy Department said it doesn't have concerns about the quality and integrity of the caverns. While there has been a lot of discussion about refilling the reserve, little consensus exists on what the right level to fill it to is, said Benjamin Salisbury, Director of Research at Height Capital Markets. That means the reserve may never reach the pre-war level, he said. Do we really want to spend $7 billion or $8 billion to refill the SPR if we are still perfectly capable of producing our own oil? Salisbury said.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, July 18th. Hovind claims city had major data breach. Attorney says, mayor, others retaliating against Brooks. Odessa Mayor Javier Hovind announced Monday that someone has accessed the city's computer network numerous times since December using former Odessa City Attorney Natasha Brooks' accounts, which someone failed to deactivate following her termination December 13th. The Odessa Police Department, with the assistance of other law enforcement agencies, launched an investigation after city officials discovered last week that sensitive information was transferred by email to a private account. A number of systems were accessed, such as Odessa Police Department reports, personnel information, and GovQA, which is the city's hosted system for public information requests, Hovind said during a press conference Monday. It's unknown at this time exactly how sensitive the transferred data was, but just the breach itself is concerning. Although the number is a fluid one, Hovind said, it appears as though 200 emails and other data were accessed. The investigation is searching if the breach happened within or without, if there was an outside hacking without the authorization or knowledge of the former employee, or was it with the direct actions of the former employee or within the city of Odessa, Hovind said. Once the investigation concludes, the city will use all means available, including criminal charges, to ensure that everyone involved in this breach is punished to the full extent of the law, Hovind said. He noted much of the information gathered could have been obtained through a Texas Public Information Act request. Hovind was asked if the investigation is connected to the recent termination of IT Director Michael Parrish. He said the council doesn't comment on personnel matters, but he also said everything is being looked at. Steps have been taken to ensure additional breaches can't take place, Hovind said. El Paso attorney John Winkie, who represents Brooks, said the city of Odessa has repeatedly engaged in acts of retaliation against his client since she was fired without explanation. What we're seeing here could be evidence of ongoing retaliation in a race and retaliation lawsuit. So, you know, it appears that the city is not being too smart in handling this matter and digging a hole that they may not be able to get out of, Winky said. According to records obtained under the Texas Public Information Act, Winky sent the city a letter back in February informing officials he was hired by Brooks, and she intended to file a legal claim against the city for breach of contract and race discrimination. He gave city officials formal notice they should not destroy, conceal, or alter in any manner any or all evidence, documents, information, electronically stored information, and or other tangible items that pertain or relate to Ms. Brooks' employment, termination, allegations of misconduct, and investigations related to these allegations. Winky wrote that during her time on the city, Brooks had consistently received favorable performance evaluations and pay raises. She'd never been disciplined, and when she was terminated, she wasn't given a termination letter or explanation, he said. Records also indicate that a month before Brooks was fired, her replacement, Dan Jones, sent an email to First Assistant Ector County District Attorney Greg Barber asking if Brooks had broken the law 2 years before she was fired by allegedly ordering staff members to backdate conflict of interest documents signed by City Council member Steve Thompson. He also asked if she had violated the law by allegedly ordering staff members to destroy the backdated documents. Jones further inquired as to whether Brooks may have committed other crimes besides destruction of government property. Jones also asked Barber to grant complete immunity to Thompson, City Secretary Norma Aguilar Grimaldo, and Public Notary Nira Enriquez. Also included amongst the emails obtained by the OA were copies of Sitter City Council member Denise Swanner's state bar complaint against Brooks, which was filed January 30th. He cited the backdated documents in her complaint and attached affidavits from Thompson, Aguilar Grimaldo, and Enriquez, alleging she had backdate the documents. As of Monday, the bar had not imposed any disciplinary measures against Brooks, whose appointment as Iowa City's attorney was also announced by emails. No responses from Barber were found in the records provided to the OA, and Ector County District Attorney Dusty Gallivan has declined to comment. Brooks still hasn't been paid what she is due under the terms of her contract, and although a mediation session was scheduled for last month, it did not take place, Winky said. The city maintains she was fired for cause and isn't entitled to severance pay. This should have been a relatively routine employer-employee dispute regarding the severance, but it has morphed into something much bigger, Winky said. Winky cited Swanner's bar complaint and Jones' letter to the district attorney's office as the first acts of retaliation, and now she's being linked to a data breach just days after she filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission alleging racism, he said. Most recently, we found out that the city leaked an EEOC charge to the Odessa Accountability Project, which seems to be a pro-Hoven administration Facebook page. These charges are confidential under federal law, and you know who leaked it might be in violation of these federal statutes, Winky said. The only people that had it was probably the city attorney's office when the EEOC charge was filed. Winky asked the latest allegations trumped up and noted it's not normal to call for press conferences about internal employee investigations. Up until now, he and his client have preferred to keep the legal dispute out of the public, but now it seems like the city's intent on trying to punish Ms. Brooks for exercising her legal rights and initially getting a severance, which was agreed upon per her contract. But since she's raised issues of race discrimination, I think we've seen a pattern of retaliation, and this is the latest, Winky said. Winky said his client doesn't have the ability to access the city's computer systems or its servers. With respect to the emails, I think one question that you need the city to answer is, did you remove Ms. Brooks' access to her emails after her termination? Okay, so I'm not sure you can have a breach if access was never revoked, Winky said. Again, Winky said it's all about retaliation. This is just kind of an ongoing effort to discredit her, to make her look bad, to embarrass her, to harm her professionally. And the question begs itself is, why are they so afraid of Natasha Brooks? Winky said. She's a former city attorney that's not working in the Midland-Odessa area anymore. Why are they so afraid of her? That's my take. I think the residents of Odessa should be concerned that certain city officials appear to be misusing or abusing their powers to target anyone who questions an or authority or disagrees with them. The city council held an almost two-hour executive session and announced they had reached a consensus to issue a sworn affidavit asking law enforcement to investigate the matter. OC hosts Preview Day Fair. Find out everything you need to know about becoming an Odessa College student and even register for classes on-site at the third annual Preview Day Fair. The community is invited to the fair from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Thursday. The event will be held in the OC Amphitheater area behind the Salisbury Campus Center. Representatives from all of the instructional departments, student organizations, student services, and student resources will be available to answer questions and assist attendees as they discover all that Odessa College has to offer them. The event will also celebrate first responders and public servants and will include demonstrations by the City of Odessa Police, Fire and Rescue, and EMS departments for students who are interested in careers in these fields. The evening's activities will include hamburgers provided by Complex Community Federal Credit Union, food trucks, music, Kids Corner, a talent show, and giveaways. Wagner Noel presents ABBA Fab. The Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, 1310 North FM 1788 Midland, will present ABBA Fab on July 21st. ABBA Fab is a stunning tribute to the music of ABBA, featuring the sensational talents of some of TAD Management's most talented and loved artists and musicians. This multimedia production is a tribute to some of the greatest music produced in the 70s and 80s, including monster hits such as Waterloo, Fernando, Honey Honey, Dancing Queen, and countless others. From ABBA's earliest hits to Mamma Mia, ABBA Fab will take you on a technicolor journey that is unmatched. The doors will open at 6:30 p.m. and the event will start at 7:30 p.m. Tickets start at $49. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit tinyurl.com/mzz3ramk. Pfluger Barra introduced bipartisan Gray Zone Defense Assessment Act. Representatives August Pfluger, Texas 11, and Dr. Ami Barra, California 6, on Friday introduced the Gray Zone Defense Assessment Act along with Representatives Daryl Issa, California 48, and Dean Phillips, Minnesota 3. This bipartisan legislation directs the United States to develop a playbook to properly counter gray zone aggression and strengthen U.S. national security. The future of warfare is evolving, Pfluger said in a news conference. We risk falling behind the curve if our nation fails to adapt and identify unconventional threats like information warfare, coercive investments and bribery, malign industrial policies, and more. The Gray Zone Defense Act is a critical first step in ensuring that the United States is prepared to assess and counter all threats to our national security. International conflicts in the 21st century have transcended traditional warfare boundaries, as demonstrated by Russia's persistent disinformation campaigns and the PRC's use of economic coercion to advance its political objectives. Said Barra in the release, yet the United States lacks a unified strategy to counter these threats, resulting in diminished influence and incentivizing our rivals to continue utilizing such tactics. I'm proud to help introduce the Bipartisan Gray Zone Defense Act to equip the United States with the necessary tools to evaluate and deter future unconventional methods. Our adversaries routinely exploit the gray zone between statecraft and war to achieve their objectives without provoking an overwhelming military response from the United States and our allies. From China's island building in the South China Sea to Iran's proxy forces destabilizing the Middle East, the United States must strategically plan and execute effective, coordinated responses that span the range of our capabilities, ISA said. This legislation does just that by focusing new attention on shoring up our process and capabilities, particularly within the interagency and State Department. That's why I'm supporting this important bipartisan effort to enhance our national security. The nature of warfare is changing, Phillips said. We've entered the era of great power competition, and we must ensure the United States is adequately prepared to identify and counter unconventional threats. The Gray Zone Defense Act provides crucial provisions to help the United States coordinate and counter malicious gray zone tactics. The Gray Zone Defense Act requires the Department of Defense, the State Department, and the Director of National Intelligence to coordinate and evaluate our nation's capacity to respond to gray zone aggression. In addition, the bill requires the Secretary of State and the Director of National Intelligence to conduct an annual assessment of the gray zone threats posed by the People's Republic of China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, and Syria posed to the United States. For two decades, U.S. warfighters have primarily been engaged in countering the threats posed by violent extremists. Asymmetric tactics utilized by these extremist groups have shown our near-peer adversaries in the great power competition that our nation is susceptible to threats that fall outside of the traditional means of conflict. Since the shift from countering violent extremism to the great power competition, Russia has used private military companies to illegally seize territories. The People's Republic of China is employing coercive economic practices through their Belt and Road initiatives, and Iran is using proxies throughout the world to export terrorism and launder money for the regime. All these actions are used as an attempt to secure national objectives in what is now called the gray zone. Although the definition of the gray zone is fluid, it is widely described as geopolitical, economic, military actions, and cyber and information operations that go beyond regular diplomatic and economic activities, but fall below the use of kinetic military force. Gray zone aggression has become the preferred method of adversarial governments because it exploits the weaknesses of Western nations and provides plausible deniability to the hostile actor. Tactics utilized in the gray zone include, but are not limited to, information warfare, encouraging internal strife within targeted countries, subversive economic practices, support for domestic and international proxies, coercive investment and bribery for political aims, industrial policy designed to monopolize or strategic industry or to destroy such an industry in other nations, military and paramilitary provocations and operations short of war, hostage diplomacy, changes in internationally recognized borders.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.